Hi everybody, today's Monday, October 28th, and we're having Colonel Jack Bow with us to talk about what's going on in the Middle East.
Welcome back, Colonel. Thank you, and thank you for inviting me again on your show. Thank you.
My pleasure. And let's get started with the Israeli attack on Iran. There are a lot of rumors out there that are talking about that the Israeli fighter jet flew deep into Iran, and they have used more than 100 fighter jets. And what do we know so far? What's your assessment of this attack on Iran?
Well, obviously, we don't know much because both Iran and Israel are very protective in terms of sharing information. But it seems that, well, first of all, what we know is that Israel has not ballistic missile capabilities that can be compared to the one of Iran, meaning that to carry on such an attack, they have to use aircraft. And they launch the ballistic missiles or the missiles with aircraft. So meaning that they need to go out of the Israeli airspace, they have to cross neighboring airspace in order to be closer to the Israeli airspace to shoot their missiles. That's the first point. Now, if they want to have some chance of success, they needed to have quite a massive launch capability, if you meaning that they had to carry out this operation with, and some said about 100 aircraft. I don't know the real figure, but that's probably true. Because again, when you have missiles, I mean, launch site, then it's easy to have, let's say, a critical mass of missiles. But when you go with aircraft, then you need to have the aircraft in the air. And that has other consequences, such as the ability of resupply, refueling in flight with tankers and things like this. So it is a very heavy operation in terms of logistics and support. So Israel carried out this operation with aircraft. Now, we know that Iran has very extensive air defense system, both from probably Russian origin, although this has not been 100% confirmed, but I think experts agree that at least there are some inactivity for Iran. And there are also Iranian systems that seems to be quite effective. In any case, what is sure is that when you start air operation with aircraft, you need to have a first phase that aims at destroying those air defense. You know, when Iran attacked Israel, they just tried to saturate the air defense system. They didn't aim at destroying the air defense system, but just saturate it. So that means that you send more targets or potential targets than Israel has in terms of air defense. And so you saturate the air defense, and then you have a hole in which you can send the real missile that will reach the real target. And that's what the Iranians have done in April and in October. Now, for the Israelis, the problem is different, because you cannot just send aircraft in order to saturate the air defense, because then you lose your aircraft and your pilots, which is obviously not what you want to have. Meaning that the first phase of an air operation such as this one must be the destruction of the air defense, in that case, Iranian air defense. And what appears to be is that the Israelis started what is called a suppression of enemy air defense, so SEAD, SEAD, or don't know how you pronounce that in English. Although the very nature of this operation, this SEAD operation, is is discussed among experts because seed is a U.S. concept that the U.S. has developed since the Vietnam War, basically, where they had to confront with very sophisticated air defense system at that time, the SA-2 guideline that the North Vietnamese used. And therefore, the U.S. tried to elaborate some tactics to overcome the air defense. And basically, the idea is that you send an aircraft, which is, detected and identified by the radars, but the aircraft doesn't go into the reach of the missile because the radar detects before the well beyond the reach of the missile. So meaning that in that space between detection and the vulnerability to a missile, then the radar of the enemy is activated, and then you use special ammunition that locks on the radar, and you destroy the radar, and then the enemy is blind, or the enemy air defense is blind, and that's the basic, very basic principle of SEAD. Now, Israel has the same problem as the West has in Ukraine, because in the past Israel has never been confronted to an enemy that has sophisticated air defense system. I mean, they bomb the civilian population or Hamas or Hezbollah, but basically these entities never had a very exhaustive and performing air defense system. As a result, Israel has a system, I mean, has attack capabilities, attack capabilities based on air superiority, period. And you have the same happening in Ukraine, by the way, that the West was not able to provide a very sophisticated air defense system to Ukraine because they don't have any. I mean, the U.S., in Iraq, Afghanistan, they never had to confront such a sophisticated system. Therefore, they didn't have enemy with air capabilities, and therefore they are not very strong in air defense system. And that's the same for Israel. But for Iran, they anticipated that Iran had a very strong air defense system, so they tried to have some kind of SEAD type of tactics. The problem is that they don't have the right equipment for that, and I'm not sure they managed to destroy as they expected or as they anticipated the air defense radars of the Iranians. They managed to destroy some of them, but probably not all of them. And for that reason, the air defense system of the Iranians remained very effective. And the operation of the Israeli was supposed to be conducted in different waves. The first wave being dedicated to destruction of this air defense. And you had following waves supposed to come and then attack the actual objectives that were defined by Israel. But apparently they were not able to go beyond the first wave, meaning that they noticed very quickly that they were not able to destroy the Iranian defense, and therefore they launched a couple of missiles. Some went through the air defense, but obviously this was not what Israel expected. And this operation was apparently supposed to last for about 10 hours or so. And in reality, it lasted only for 3 hours because, in fact, it was aborted by the Israelis because they noticed that they couldn't even go beyond to break through the air defense system. So they would probably have, I mean, probably some missile went through because a very tight air defense is almost impossible, regardless of your system, regardless of how many and you always have a hole somewhere. So and that's probably the case for this particular strike, that Israel, Israel found some holes in the defense and eventually reached a couple of objectives. I don't know exactly what is the actual success of the Israeli strikes. There were some satellite imagery that appeared on the internet. What I've seen is that there were some damages, but probably not as substantial as expected by the Israelis. And the targets were also some old nuclear program building that was abandoned in about 20 years. So I don't know exactly what the Israelis were doing. My view is that the Israelis didn't want to target big cities or big things. They probably focused on military objectives because they probably didn't want to go into a massive escalation, but they just wanted to respond. We are still in this kind of tit for tat cycle, and they needed to respond, as Iran will say they will respond, because again we are in this kind of cycle, and as long as nobody has said, well, okay, let's keep it that way, as long as none of both actors has said so, that will continue. So the Israelis have not reached the objective. So in my view, if we look at this, if we take into account the expectations or the probable expectations, I would say this didn't demonstrate a very superiority of Israel. And in my view, in that sense, it's not a success. The previous strike from Iran to Israel was a success, definitely, because in fact the Iranians on both strikes, the one of the 13th of April and the one of the 1st of October, they managed to saturate the Israeli air defense and to reach the objectives they wanted to reach. So therefore, they reached the objectives. In that case, for that particular strike from Israel, they didn't reach their objective. In that sense, it's not a success. And that underlines, by the way, the capabilities of Iran that have been consistently underestimated by the West and by Israel. And here we see some kind of a pattern, because we have seen that Israel was not able to assess properly the Palestinian capabilities in Gaza. And in fact, they were surprised by the preparedness of the resistance in the Gaza Strip. In 2006, remember that Israel had not been able to assess the real potential of the Hezbollah. Eventually, they got surprised and had to withdraw. And we have a similar pattern developing now in South Lebanon, that the Israelis are not able to assess, or were not able to assess, the real capabilities of Hezbollah. Now they get surprised. And we had the same with Iran. So this is, and if we can even see a parallel here with what we have seen in Ukraine, with the West underestimating consistently Russian capabilities. So it seems that we have in the West, and in that word I include Israel, we have this sense of superiority that is probably more a myth than a reality, by the way. And we base our assessment of the enemy on this kind of sense of superiority. But we don't really assess the real value of enemy forces and capabilities. And I think this should be a major source of concern both for NATO as regards the European theater, and Israel when it comes to its situation, not just with Iran, by the way, but also with other countries. I have told you many times that my contacts with Middle Eastern armies when I was in NATO indicated that these armies, they are very disciplined and therefore they follow the orders of the political leadership, which is normal for an armed force. And that's the purpose of an armed force, to follow the political the decision of the political leadership. But would this leadership change its mind, then Israel would face a very, very difficult situation, because most of those, if not all of those militaries not only militaries, by the way, I have also contacted some intelligence guys, and they have the same opinion. So none have any sympathy for Israel. They are just following the political guidance, period. But would that change? Then the picture would totally change with Israel. So the Israel has a picture of the situation which is based on the influence of the US on the region and on the sense of superiority it has. And to some extent, it's a wrong sense of superiority, because in the past, Israel was always a superior because it attacked its enemy. And it attacked its enemy when they were not prepared. And that was very clear in 1967, for instance. 1973 was another scenario. But it prevailed also because of the support of the US, otherwise it wouldn't have. So the sense of superiority is somehow, let's say, exaggerated, because it was exaggerated by exploiting false experience from the past to some extent. And that's, I think, is something I would, if I were Israeli military, I would be very worried about my ability to assess the enemy, and I would certainly strongly revise this. So that's one point. There is another point that has not been so much mentioned, but I think it may have some importance. It's the fact that, as I said before, when you use aircraft, then you have to cross the airspace of neighboring countries. Now, in the case of Israel, these neighboring countries are basically Jordan, Syria, and Iraq to reach the Iranian border. And apparently, in order to perform this operation, Israel had to rely on a, let's say, artificial airspace created by the US. I said artificial airspace because obviously the US presence in Syria and to some extent in Iraq is illegal. And therefore, having a US airspace in that area is something artificial, because normally you have the Syrian airspace, the Jordanian airspace, and the Iraqi airspace. But apparently these countries would probably have denied Israel their airspace for such an operation of Israel. So Israel used this corridor provided by the US, meaning that, in fact, in that particular situation, US was an active participant to the strike. And it's probably not a surprise if we had yesterday, that was Sunday, we had a couple of attacks on US bases in Syria by some Syrian militias. And I don't have any crystal ball, but we may expect, or let's say the U.S. should expect probably more attacks on their bases, because not only their presence is illegal, but in addition to that, they are taking part to operation of Israel against a neighboring country. So this airstrike at the end is a tactical failure, because apparently the Israel was not able to destroy these air defense, the Iranian air defense. So that's a tactical failure. It's an operational failure because the operation was not carried out in its full extent, and therefore I see that as an operational failure. And it's a strategic failure because, again, it puts the U.S. in the in the crosshair of the local militias, and it underlined something we have seen with the Gaza operation and all that. It underlined the inherent weakness of Israel. That means that Israel is strong for very specific type of action, obviously very strong to destroy civilians, as they have done in South Lebanon and all that. But when it comes to confront kind of a peer structure, a peer army, a peer armed force, then it seems that they are not as strong as they claim. And that will add to this image that we have from Israel since October last year. It's a country that is able, or let's say it's successful when it takes people by surprise, but attacking unarmed enemies. But when it comes to armed enemies, when it comes to situation they are not able to cope with because they are not intellectually prepared for that. And remember that the 7th of October failed, not simply because there was a surprise caused by the Palestinians, but mainly because the command and control structure of the Israeli failed, because they never anticipated a situation in which they would have to respond massively and with the whole capabilities of the so-called Gaza division. That's the division of Israeli army that is in charge of the security of the so-called Gaza envelope around the Gaza Strip. And this division failed completely. And all the command and control structure collapsed completely, because there was no redundancy in the sensor, the sensors around the Gaza Strip. There was no redundancy in the command and control structure. And therefore, as soon as the command post of the Gaza division had been isolated, then everything collapsed. So we see that Israel is very only, let's say, successful when it is stronger as the enemy, but is not able to cope with situation it has not been able to anticipate. And we have a similar situation with Hezbollah now, because the objectives that were set for the IDF, that means taking a kind of create a buffer zone in South Lebanon, apparently it's not going as planned. And they are withdrawing some units. The soldiers themselves are not prepared for the kind of operation. Soldiers themselves seem also to suffer from exactly the same syndrome, if you want, the syndrome of superiority. They feel that they are better, that they are stronger, they are more clever than the enemy. But at the end of the day, they see that the enemy is more determined than they are. They are better trained than they are. They are better prepared to fight under harsh conditions than they are. And eventually, we see those soldiers end up in psychiatric hospitals, showing that we have an army that is very strong if the weather is nice. But as soon as the weather degrades, then the Israeli army is not able to cope with the situation. And I think we have exactly, that's what this last strike on Iran just demonstrated, that this was not really well prepared. I mean, they were not able to anticipate all the contingencies that they would encounter. As a result, the operation, they can probably claim some kind of success because they can show some pictures of some damages. And I'm not able to assess if those damages were extensive or how strongly affected the Iranian system. I have no idea. But they can claim this success, okay? But at the end, it's probably well, let's say the anticipated objective was well beyond this kind of result. Let's put it that way. So that's my take on that system. And by doing so, without achieving much, they give Iran the ability to respond, because we are in this kind of cycle, which is a virtuous cycle. But that's the reality in which we are. And now everybody is asking Iran not to strike. We have seen Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, asking Iran not to strike. Although nobody has asked, I mean, the Americans have tried to influence Israel, but not the other Europeans have never tried to suggest Israel not striking. So that's also something, by the way, that indirectly shows that we consider that the other actors are rational actors, while Israel is not rational. Therefore, there is no, let's say, point trying to ask Israel to have some measured response, because this will never be the case. The others can respond, let's say, rationally and reasonably, but not Israel. That's a reason why they ask others to restrain or for restrain. So that's an interesting aspect, I think, we should also mention here.
Yeah. When we talk about the conflict between Iran and Israel, it's all about deterrence. And because we know that they don't want to, the way Iran attacked Israel, they didn't want to destroy even air bases. They want to send a message to Israel. And right now, do you think which of these countries was able to establish deterrence? And the way that Iranians are talking about, if you look at the Iranian media, they don't feel it's all limited. I don't see any sign of that they're angry, they're not happy with this situation. It seems that they're so calm, they don't feel that it was a huge deal for them. But what's your assessment? How do you see it? Who was able to establish deterrence, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, what your observation relates very much to something I have mentioned a couple of times on your channel and others, by the way, that for a Muslim, responding or the ability to respond is already a success. And that's something which is important. The victory for a Muslim is not related to the amount of destruction you bring to the enemy, but the idea of victory is related to your ability and your willingness more than ability to respond. Meaning that if you keep the head high, and you say, I will respond. As long as you strike, I will respond. That's already a victory. And that's probably the reason why you have in such situation exactly what you just described about the Iranian population, that people are very calm. Because again, just the fact, the mere fact that they are able and willing to respond is already a success. While on the other hand, on the Israeli side, they need to destroy the enemy. They have to scare the enemy to have some kind of a sense of success. So that's about the mentalities. Now, when we talk about deterrence, when you talk about deterrence, it's not just about the mentality, your mentality, but it's about how you are perceived by the enemy. That's, deterrence is about perception. It's not about what you do. It's definitely how it is perceived by the enemy. And that's where we have a danger here. Because, again, Israel has a Western mentality, meaning that they understand the war as a balance of forces, if you want. And the stronger you fight, the more victorious you appear. So it's all about that, which is in fact that's the reason why, by the way, Western armies never manage to defeat Iraqis. I mean, they had defeat, I mean, technical defeat in the sense that they destroyed tank and artillery and all that. But they never defeated the willingness to resist. That's the same in Afghanistan, by the way, that you have, the Americans could destroy everything, but at the end of the day, what remains is the willingness to fight. So the Americans had the feeling that they were superior and they could use some kind of deterrence towards their enemy, while for the others, they don't care because the amount of destruction is not relevant. The thing is that regardless of how people you destroy, I will respond, and that's my victory. So meaning that in the case of Iran, even if Iran is moderate, that will be perceived by Israel as a weakness. And that's where you have this kind of asymmetry. Not dissymmetry, but asymmetry. Asymmetry is the different, the way you perceive things. Probably to illustrate my point. How can you deter a terrorist with death if this guy is ready to die? You see, we are here in two different types of thinking, different type of mindset. And that's exactly what we are seeing at play in between Iran, and not just Iran, by the way, but between Israel and its neighbors. It's exactly that. The neighbors, they say, you attack us and we will respond. Regardless of the price, we our honor, so to say, is to willing not to abandon the fight. We will not abandon the fight. And therefore, to some extent, this could explain the position of Israel, because probably Israel has understood that at the end they have to destroy everybody. Because as soon as you have one person who will say, no, regardless of the number of people killed, I will respond, meaning that Israel is not successful. And that we are in this kind of very strange situation where you have not just two armies that confronting themselves, but we have two mindsets, two different logic. And I think that's a key to understand our fight against terrorism. And by the way, that's exactly what I'm trying to explain in the book that is just behind me there, the defeating the jihadi terrorists, because that's the key aspect of for defeating terrorism, is to understand the mindset of the terrorists. You need to understand whatever the war, whatever the enemy, in wherever part of the world you are. If you fight a war, you have to understand the mindset of your enemy. Understand the mindset doesn't mean that you have to be like them, doesn't mean that you have to accept that, but you have to understand who they think and who and why they act. And that's exactly the weakness of the West at large. And that's very concentrated in Israel, because in addition to have this Western mentality, you have this sense of racial or ethnic superiority that is in Israel. I mean, what they call human animals and subhuman Palestinians and things like this. You have this inherent sense of superiority that, in fact, prevents the Israelis to understand the mindset of their adversaries. As a result, that's why I wrote, that's exactly what I wrote in 2003 in my first book on the asymmetric warfare. I said, Israel cannot be winning. That will take the time, but it will not win because Israel is not able to understand the mindset and the logic of its adversaries. So when we talk about this deterrence, then we are here in a very in a conundrum, because Iran feels satisfied with the fact that it was able to respond, that it was able to bring an effective response on Israeli territory, and I fully agree with you, they didn't want to destroy anything. I mean, they wanted to bring some military destruction on military objectives, but it was very limited in scope and in nature. And they are satisfied with that, because from their point of view, they responded, and therefore they are victorious somehow. But when you look from a Western point of view, you say, well, but they didn't destroy much. They don't have the capability of destroying more and things like this. Meaning that here, this is where those different logic collide. And eventually, Iran might well be pushed into a situation that they will not be just satisfied by what they have done, but they really have to make Israel feeling that they are weak. And in order to make Israel feeling that they are weak, they should probably go to more massive strikes. And that's a danger, because at the same time, you have Israel that has this kind of messianic understanding of its position in the Middle East, by the way. So it's the messianic substance in the very doctrine of the Israeli state. But this messianic type of behavior can evolve into something that go to kind of unlimited destruction capabilities. And that's where I think the Iranians are so far, in my view, very prudent. I have no idea. I mean, experience shows that the rest of the world understands better the West than the West understands the rest of the world. And that's very true in the case of Israel and its neighbors. And I'm not precluding that Iran has perfectly understood this asymmetry in logic and in mindset. And that's explained why, despite all this, Iran remains moderate in its type of counter-strikes. So that's my view. And in my view, this is a wise stance. Because again, you don't know exactly how Israel react. The problem of Israel is that it has an inherent sense of superiority. But in addition to that, for good or bad reason, they are convinced that if the situation would degrade or escalate significantly, then the West, and namely the US, would come into the game. And that's probably the reason why Israel, it's more difficult to deter Israel, because they have this feeling that regardless of the situation, the US may jump in. And therefore, it may give a false sense of understanding. I mean, in terms of deterrence, again, deterrence is a question of perception. And if you know that you're backed with a very, very strong enemy, then you are not so easily deterred. See, so we are, that's why this situation is very dangerous, because we have, I think Iranians are definitely rational in their in the way they react and act. But on the side of Israel, and I would even include the U.S., because in the U.S. you see that there is so different understanding of the situation. I mean, you have those who vote to destroy Israel, Iran, and they claim that, and you have those Lindsey Graham and others since years, they ask for the full destruction of Iran. And on the other hand, you have people who are a little bit more realistic, because probably they are in power. That's probably some people in the State Department who understand, and in the Pentagon. I think the Pentagon are probably the more reasonable, because they know what war is. That's probably the reason. But you never know how this mindset may shift in US, and if there is an opportunity to destroy Iran, whatever it means, by the way, because destroying Iran is a huge enterprise if you think about it. But there are some people that are completely irrational in the, especially some politicians, and therefore you can expect any kind of thing. So this is why we are, I think, in a very, very dangerous situation.
Yeah. When we look at the Israeli Channel 12 military correspondent Nir Devori, he reported on this channel that only 3 Hezbollah fighters killed and wounded an entire Israeli forces of 20 soldiers. And the way that you see Israel right now in the southern part of Lebanon, with this escalation with Iran and what's going on in Gaza, it doesn't seem that Israel is gaining anything in terms of security, in terms of their military, in terms of political advantage on the other parties. Do you see a total collapse on the part of the Netanyahu administration? How do you evaluate this? Because we had a funeral in Israel and about the Israeli soldiers, that people were not happy with the situation, with the hostages, with the security. People want to go to the northern part of Israel, to their homes. They're not capable of going there. With this operation in the southern part of Lebanon, it doesn't seem that they're going to solve anything. And with the situation of Iran, even the picture of Israel is not that we've imagined before October 7. As time goes by, it seems that they're melting down in all the fronts, together with their picture in the mind of the Arab states, who were, I would say, they were afraid of Israel before October 7. Right now, nobody knows what's going on in the mind of the Arab states, in the mind of Turkey. How do you see all these pictures together?
Well, I, again, this underlines the kind of irrationality that prevails in the Israeli leadership. And when I say Israeli leadership, in fact, you know, yes, you have people demonstrating because they want the return of hostages and they would like to have a strategy that helps bringing back the hostages. But at the same time, those people don't look for any kind of appeasement with the Palestinians. So we see this Israeli society is not really divided, it's mentally divided between two extremes or different extremes, but the society itself is more or less united. I mean, they hate Palestinians. I think as a general rule, they probably may differ in the way we should eliminate Palestinians. That's probably the difference. But in essence, you can see that the support, there is no real demonstration against the strategy in Gaza, for instance. There is no real, there is no demonstration against the way Israel has destroyed Gaza or kills children, or there's no, on the contrary, you have people, citizens, I mean, Israeli citizens, preventing humanitarian aid to access Gaza. You see? So we see a society, in my view, which is definitely, I said, when I was talking about the West, I said I include Israel. But at the same time, it doesn't seem that the Israelis have really the mentality that we have in Europe. In Europe, even you have extremists on different sides, and I mean, you have all the diversity of mindsets that you have. But in general, we could see that Europe at large, and I talk about the not talking about politicians, I talk about the population in Europe understands that war is never a good solution. And destroying infrastructure, killing people, children, and all that doesn't bring anything. I think the European population understands that. I'm not sure the politicians do, because as we have seen as regard Israel, nobody has condemned really Israel for that. You see, you have a report from the United Nations and even report of the United Nations asking the international community not supporting Israel in its activity, but apparently it has absolutely no impact on our leaders. So meaning that here we should differentiate between the leaders and the population. The leaders have absolutely no idea of what war. I mean, war is just something abstract, and the Israelis are their friends, and so let's kill people, and that's it. That's the case of Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, who just said on the 10th of October in front of the German parliament, she said that we should abandon the idea of protected zone for civilians. Because as soon as you have terrorists hiding in the population, then the whole population becomes a target. That's what it says. So this is something which is just ununderstandable for the common sense of the European. But in Israel, you don't see this kind of relation, or maybe a very very limited scope. You have very courageous organizations such as B'Tselem and other who are militantly fighting for the rights of the Palestinians and to abandon these policies of occupation and all that. So you have some groups, but they are isolated basically, because the population is basically following the government. The problem of Israel is that it has lost a very considerable positive image in the rest of the world. And I think basically everywhere, because if one day the ICG declares that Israel is committing genocide, I'll remind you that so far it's talk about the plausibility of a genocide, but if they come to the point that they can say Israel is committing genocide, and when we see the documents that have been recently published by the special envoy of the UN on this issue, Mrs. Albanese of the UN. She has created a website, by the way, forensic architecture. It's related to the forensic architecture on the Gaza issue. And it's a very impressive website, by the way, that demonstrates the scope of the destruction and the scope of the war crimes committed by Israel, by the way. And she talks about genocide openly, although this has not been, as I said, defined univocally by the ICG. But in any case, the day the ICG decides that it's a genocide, then you will see all these politicians in the West that then will be accomplices of genocide. That may change radically the way Israel will be. I think for the rest of the world, Israel is committing genocide. And that, I think, for good or right, I don't know, but in any case, this will affect the relationship between Israel and the rest of the world durably. I think that will certainly last for years. Now with the West, it's a different issue. But again, the day we have a judgment from the ICG, then probably the things will turn and will have a totally different relationship with Israel, in my view. And Israel should be aware of that. The problem is that when we talk about deterrence, we are talking about this. Switzerland had also a policy of deterrence militarily. But it's interesting to see the word, the how we understand deterrence. For a while, as I probably told you, the Swiss government contemplated the idea of having nuclear weapons. And in the 60s, we had a project that lasted up to the early 90s, by the way, to have or to acquire nuclear weapons. In fact, the project was abandoned in the late 70s as Switzerland signed the non-proliferation treaty. But officially, the program remained open until the 90s. In any case, we had this idea of having nuclear weapons for the sake of deterrence. But when we decided that we will adhere to the non-proliferation treaty, we decided to keep this idea of deterrence, but not in the way, and that's interesting, the different type of perception that we with the Israelis. Because in Switzerland, we say our deterrence will be as follows. We'll defend every single inch of our territory, and we decide to have an army, a popular army. So it's not a professional army, it's a popular army. And we had up to 800,000 people in the army. For a small country like Switzerland. During the Cold War, up to the early 90s, we had something like 800,000 people in the army. Officially, it was 600,000, or 650,000. But in the reality, it was 800,000. And beyond this, we'll have a program to protect every single citizen of the country, meaning that we built nuclear shelters in every single house in Switzerland. and every official building, even in tunnels, you had public shelters or individual shelters, so the whole population could be. And that's what's considered deterrent, because that means that nobody could blackmail Switzerland by using nuclear weapons, for instance, because the population is protected. And you cannot, if you want to enter the country, if you have you step 1 meter on the country, you will be welcomed by our army. That's the way we conceive deterrence. So that's a self-centered type of deterrence, if you want. While Israel has another way of deterrence. So your deterrence is made by the fact that you have to scare the others. The use of disproportionate force, the use of indiscriminate force, and that should deter the others from attacking. So we have here two different views for various countries of similar size, Switzerland and Israel, two different understanding of the world, the word deterrence in a different context, but probably with more durable aspects, because on a Swiss side, and probably Switzerland is not perfect, but that's the example I know, this kind of deterrence could be combined with the idea of having a stable environment to develop stable and cooperative relationship with our neighbors. While the way Israel understands its deterrence precludes any kind of cooperation with its neighbors. It even precludes any kind of stable relationship with its neighbors. And that's why Israel always strives to develop instability in its neighbors. That was the case in the 80s in South Lebanon, and that's, by the way, what created Hezbollah, and in Syria, and even in Egypt. So you have a country that has based its the whole national security concept on the use of force, the use of indiscriminate force, and the absence of cooperation with its neighbors. And if the Americans were not here, there wouldn't have been any agreement with Egypt or Jordan, by the way. Because these were, in fact, those agreements or peace agreements with both Egypt and Jordan were, in fact, the product of U.S. pressure on Israel. So we have here, when we talk about deterrence and all that, I think the whole concept of, or perception even, of Israel in its neighborhood has been false or falsified from the very beginning. And as a result, Israel and its diplomacy, by the way, was never able to demonstrate its added value in the region. Now, Israel comes up as a problem in the region, not as a solution, you know? And of course, this goes back to the way Israel, with quotation mark, implemented resolution 181. In fact, it never implemented it. But the thing is that the way Israel gained the territories and eventually created its state, the way it reached that point, in fact, was almost precluded any kind of cooperation with its neighbor. And later, after 1985, the Israelis were never able to try to reconstruct some kind of stable relationships with the neighbors. and trying to, let's say, implement the UN resolutions in a way that could be acceptable to the countries in the region. You know, as an example, in order to be accepted in the UN in 1949, Israel had to declare that it would comply with international humanitarian right, law. It would comply with international law, and it would comply with the right of return of the Palestinians. And that's what it did in 1949. And since then, not a single step towards the implementation of this declaration / promise was done. So in that sense, if you are a neighboring country of Israel, you see a country that give its word for something, but never realizes it. So it's not a country of its word. So how can you have an appeased relationship with a country that doesn't even respect its own word? And that's, I think, something that Israel needs to realize. And the fact nobody helped Israel or tried to convince Israel to implement the various UN General Assembly and UN Security Council resolutions. In the West, everybody was happy with the situation of Israel. And nobody tried to convince them to do so, to respect this resolution. This behavior of the West, in fact, has led Israel into a dead end, in fact, because today Israel is confronted with a situation that it has never, never complied with international law. So what can you do with such a country? And that's the reason why some countries today, and that was recently, I saw that a few days ago, some people ask to expel Israel from the UN. Because that was the condition for the Israel to join the UN to comply with the right of return for the Palestinians. And they didn't fulfill that promise. They didn't fulfill this condition as a result. So we see that the more time goes, the more Israel gets taken into its own mistakes. And the West has never been able to indicate Israel that it was going or heading for a dead end.
Yeah. And in your opinion, with the way that the Netanyahu administration is behaving right now, and the way that we can see Antony Blinken's latest visit to Israel, was that a win for the Biden administration? The way that we can say the problem between Iran and Israel is not that much escalated as it was before the Israeli attack on Iran. And the situation is, we can consider it that both sides are somehow satisfied with the situation. But is that a win for the Biden administration?
No, I don't think it's a win. And I think that's the problem that the Joe Biden and Biden administration, or let's say even Kamala Harris, if you want, has now for the presidential election, is that it has no result, basically, because the legacy of this situation is an unsolved situation with no prospect for solution. That's the thing, you know. The Biden administration has not even been able to initiate a process. And I think that's a first failure, if you want, because the situation in the Middle East or in Palestine is so complex. It's not complex, but let's say it's so intricate that it would be very optimistic to foresee a success or some kind of a solution within weeks or months. This is a problem that is lasting for decades, and it will probably need more time to find a right solution. But the fact that Biden is leaving this administration without any idea, without the first sign of a process for solving the problem, that shows the inability of the Biden administration. But at this point, we also have to say we are talking about the Biden administration because Biden is president. But Donald Trump didn't do better before. And it's probably not to expect from him any improvement if he gets elected. And that shows, by the way, the very complex relationship you have between Israel and the US. And during the Cold War, and probably up to the early 2000s, US could probably have some kind of leverage over Israel and could probably influence decisions in Israel. But we see today that regardless of the government, in fact, the US does what Israel wants. And that's probably not just because Netanyahu is in power, but also because within the US, we have forces that in fact act not in favor of the US, but in favor of Israel, even if it is at the expense of US interests. And that's something that is, in my view, very worrying, because we see the same thing in France. We see something very similar developing in France, that you have people taking influence over the government, and that may not be in tune with the interests of, in that case, France, or even Europe, we could say. And therefore, we tend to have our policies and our policies toward the Middle East that are not driven by a good and harmonious solution in the region, but are driven by the sole interest of Israel. And we see that this cannot be durable. We see that it cannot last, because if we talk about a region, then we should take into consideration the interest of the various actors and not just focusing just on the interest of one. And even if especially if the interests of this one are extremely specific, and these interests can only be validated at the expense of the interests of the others. So, you know, if you help someone saying, oh, by helping him, I help also the neighbors, that would be fine. But that's not the case. If we help Israel, that would be at the expense of the others. So, meaning that we have a situation which is inherently unstable, that the West has created by supporting Israel. By supporting blindly, because it's not the fact that we should not support Israel, but we should help Israel to comply with the rules of the international community. The Israeli complain all the time that this Israel has been condemned by so many resolutions of the UN and all that, and therefore the UN is anti-Semitic and all that. And the reality is that if there are so many resolutions against Israel, it's because Israel doesn't behave well. That's the reason. So there is a point where as we try to help or we want to help, and you have so many program and project wanting to help Georgia, Moldova, all these countries funded by the US, they should have a program to help Israel to comply with international law and to be better integrated in the international community. And this would not happen. The situation that we are witnessing would not happen. So we devote a lot of energy trying to force other countries to be like us. And at the same time, we let Israel do whatever they want. At the same time, the problem is precisely that Israel is probably like us. And that's probably not a good qualification for us.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Colonel, in your opinion, recently we've learned that Iran and Saudi Arabia are going to have a joint naval drill. Those in the Red Sea. How do you see the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia, Turkey, UAE, these countries who are part of the Middle East that are so important for the conflict in Gaza? Are these countries getting closer to each other? That, and would that help the situation in Gaza? Because at the end of the day, I think the main concern is in Gaza, is not in Lebanon, even in Lebanon, because Israel is not capable of continuing this conflict in the southern part of Lebanon. But Gaza is the main concern right now. It seems that they don't want to leave the northern part of Gaza. They want to send people there, they want to reconstruct, send settlers there. How do you see the situation in terms of what's going on among the countries in the Middle East?
Well, I think, you know, we have in the last quarter of a century, last 25 years, we had a very distorted vision or understanding of what was going on in the Middle East because of the U.S. intervention, mainly this kind of obsession of terrorism everywhere. And therefore, we tried to, I mean, what we have done, but mainly the U.S., but also other countries like the U.K., France, Poland, Ukraine, and all that. We have contributed to destabilize this region significantly. Remember that Iran has never attacked any other country since the 18th century or something like that. I think Saudi Arabia has not and had even enough domestic issues to solve before thinking expanding itself. Meaning that there were not particular problems between those states. And the problems have arisen from the Western presence, because we needed to have allies and enemies and things like this. And we have completely destabilized this region for a quarter of a century. What's happening today, and what I'm saying can probably be related to the recent BRICS summit and things like this. The thing is that now countries from the rest of the world, and in particular from the Near East, understand that they may have common interest in working together. And to go beyond religious, let's say, rivalries, which in my view, for the last centuries, were not really an issue. mean, probably they have some scholars who will contradict me, but my personal view is that beyond intellectual diverging views and discussions, religious rivalries between Shi'i and Sunni were not a major geopolitical issue or even geostrategic issue. The West has, in fact, created those geopolitical and geostrategic issues. Today, we have kind of a return to normal in the sense that the locomotive of world's economy is China, which incidentally is a BRIC country. China is probably looking for a domination, but not a military or political domination, but a trade problem, because they have a huge of things to sell and to buy, and therefore trade is their way of managing things. And in that respect, everybody understands that when you have you trade with a superpower with no strings attached, it's preferable than having or dealing with some Western power with all sorts of strings attached to what you do. I mean, the Chinese will not ask you what are your laws about LGBT, whatever, when they sell you something. They just sell you something. And your laws is your problem. Well, in the West, when we start to have trading relationships, then we put condition on that. You need to have this and to allow that. And so, you know, and people understand then that dealing with Oriental, Eastern powers, like Russia, like China, like India, it's much more easy because they just go to the substance of things, and then you manage your own business. And everybody understands that. And that's probably the reason why you have this rapprochement, because this rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia has not been forced by anybody. You know, at the end of the day, both Iran and Saudi Arabia were willing to do that because they see that's in their interest. And they have a common interest because mostly they are in the same business, namely oil and this kind of things. They are in the same region. So they have an interest to have a stable region where you can trade freely, that you are not threatened by any kind of overseas power who would come and threaten dictating you what you have to do. So I think this, in that sense, we could see that the rest of the world, and more specifically, when we talk about Saudi Arabia and Iran, we have two countries who have a mature understanding of their national security and of their foreign policy. And both are connected, by the way. So this is the result of this very mature understanding of their environment, understanding of their policies, of their strategies. And my view is that we are now in a process that will take some speed in the next week, because it's in the interest of all the actors. You go beyond your rivalries, you go beyond the different issues you may have. We see that, by the way, just before the BRICS summit, we just had this announcement that India and China will resume or initiate some talks and negotiations about the border issue. And that's exactly what I figure out should be in the in terms of relation, not sanctioning and pressuring and threatening with the use of weapons. By the way, if you look at this, we had the Security Cooperation Organization, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, sorry, that had its summit a couple of weeks ago in Ashgabat. We have now the BRICS summit. And when we talk about the Security Cooperation or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it's a cooperation. But talking about cooperation, that's what you have in OSCE, Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe. And that's exactly the model Russia wanted for Europe at the end of the Cold War. They suggested that NATO would disband and be replaced by a structure that would consider security, not security by confrontation, but security by cooperation. And OSCE, by the way, is the result of an initiative of the Soviet Union at the time. So this idea of security through cooperation is something that is very deep entrenched in the Russian mentality. And we are seeing that in the rest of the world as well. And we have seen, I don't know if you have seen the picture of the Kazan meeting, the BRICS summit, and you see the president of Armenia talking very friendly to the president of Azerbaijan. Meaning that we have a platform where you can talk. There are problems. These problems are there. They are not removed. They are there. But at the same time, you can talk with each other. And that's, I think, is the future of international relations. When you start to exclude people from the Council of Europe or Russia and things like this, you don't talk to them, you don't trade with them, you don't connect, you isolate them, you ostracize them, and all that. This is the way, that's how we did centuries ago, isolating things instead of having platform when you can talk and discuss. You solve your problem by talking, not by excluding. And I think that's what we are seeing at play in the Middle East with Iran and Saudi Arabia. But that at large, that will affect the whole of the rest of the world, which, by the way, doesn't include Israel. So again, if I were an Israel leader, I would be very worried to be because Israel is not a European country, doesn't belong to NATO, doesn't belong to the European Union. There are some partnership relationship, but they are not part of this. It's not part of the rest of the world either. You see, we have a country that isolates itself more and more. So it's probably time for the Israeli leadership to have some kind of mature approach of their future, of their national security, and of their foreign policy, and to understand that they will survive only if they are integrated in the international community. And integrated in the international community is not just an exercise when you decide that you're integrated. You are integrated when you demonstrate that you are an added value for the community. You see? And this added value can take different forms. If I take the example of Switzerland, I very often say Switzerland is the poorest country of Europe. Everybody laughs at me when I say so, because today, obviously, Switzerland is probably the richest country. But it used to be the poorest country of Europe. It's the country which is landlocked, which is very difficult for agriculture, that has no natural resources. And the added value of Switzerland for a very long time, by the way. The added value of Switzerland was its capability of fighting, because we have those mercenaries around the world. And that was our added value for a while, and it remained the only mercenary service allowed is the Vatican, the Pope's guards. This is only allowed. But that was our added value. And after a while, we understood that making war is not an added value for, because especially not for us, because we had people dying all over the world. And we realized, but we realized something, that mercenary service is a service. And the added value is to provide a service. And we started with other kind of services, bank services, banking, some more services that in fact become and are still the trademark of Switzerland. We cannot provide oil, we cannot provide, but we can provide a goodwill. We can provide our neutrality. We can provide our assistance in resolving conflict. We can provide this kind of thing. Meaning that demonstrating that you're at an added value is not a matter of forcing people to accept you, but it's a matter of convincing people that you can help them, that you can add something to their own management, leadership, relationship, and all of this. And that's, I think, something that Israel needs to work out. And as long as Israel doesn't understand that, as long as it thinks that it will be integrated only by imposing its presence by force, by destruction, by killing people around him, Israel will not be part of the international community, and you will have more and more people wanting Israel to be expelled from the UN. So it's a mindset that, in my view, has to be changed here. And I appeal the international community to help Israel to do so, because with their mentality, with their culture, they are not in a position to make these changes. Some people have to help them to do so. And that's my view, that the West and others probably, but at least the West, should help Israel to do so. And that's for the benefit of the whole region. I mean, I think the decision to that the West did in 1947 was not a good decision, in the sense that if you read the estimate of the CIA in October 1947, it said we should not accept this partition plan because Israel will try to take advantage of this and ask for more territories. In any case, the modalities were not good. That if we wanted to give a territory for the Jews, why not? That should have been better monitored and managed by the international community. We failed to do so. And by failing to do so, we gave the Israelis a sense of impunity and of almightliness that, in fact, has a problem with it. So whether or not that was good, well done, 79 years ago, we can discuss the matter. The fact is that today it is what it is, and we have to cope with the situation as it is today. We cannot go back in time. We have to deal with the situation. And today, my view is that we should encourage Israel to, let's say, to integrate itself by convincing people that they are an added value, and you cannot be an added value if you destroy your neighbors. So it's a matter of choice.
Thank you so much, Colonel, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me again. Thank you. My pleasure.